Four more to vote for.
Great, we're going to call the committee to order. This is the Transportation and Public Safety Committee meeting of Wednesday, January 28th, 2015. And welcome, members. Members, today we're going to hear from MnDOT. Your agenda says we're going to hear about the major highway projects and trunk highway fund expenditures, but I think you also saw an email from Suzanne Sabatka that said that indicated we'd also be hearing from MnDOT, kind of related to this subject broadly, about the project selection process, efforts around efficiencies, some words about materials management and bridge maintenance as well. And so welcome to the committee, Ms. Hatch, and I'll let you take it away and present however you deem best.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On all those topics.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. We are delighted to be here to showcase one of the major pieces that we work on throughout the year, and that is the major highway projects report, and it also includes the trunk highway fund expenditures section. And I'll walk through the report. I'll confess to you that your PowerPoint is going to be slightly out of order. We're going to change the order a little bit, but I'll be happy to walk you through and explain exactly where we are. So in terms of your handout, I believe it starts on page 39. And we do have a number of slides. We will do our best to get through as much as we can in the time allotted. We will allow for time for questions. And certainly, if you have any follow-up or would like us to come back and provide greater detail or less, feel free to let us know that.
Thank you.
So you should see the slide that I have here on the screen. By the way, for the record, my name is Tracy Hatch, and I have the role of Deputy Commissioner, Chief Financial Officer, and Chief Operating Officer here at MnDOT. I also have with me today Nancy Daubenberger, who is our Engineering Services Division Director and was formerly our bridge engineer. And then I also have Glenn Engstrom, who is the Office Director for our Materials Management Office. So they will be presenting a little bit later on. So again, beginning on page 39 of your slide deck, I'm here to present a little bit of information, sort of high-level overview, on the major projects report and the information contained in that report. There are essentially six major elements to the report, as well as an appendix that is really listed here as number 7, and that lists detailed project summaries. There are 377 projects for which we have detailed summaries, and so we just found it best to include that as an appendix rather than in the body of the report. I do believe you have the beginning sections of the report, and I think in terms of your packets, and I do think that the project sections were excluded from that packet just to save trees. But the full report is found on our website, and I know the your library has that as well.
And members, we also sent that out as a link, so look to your email if you want to read the whole thing. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, as you know, this was is a report required by law, Minnesota Statute 174.56. And in 2012, we had a number of pieces that were amended in that statute that increased the requirements for the report and also added a couple of additional elements, which I'll touch on as we go. The early part of the report lays out the programming process. The project selection process gets a little bit more into detail. We'll cover some of that here this afternoon. But the overall programming process, we like to begin with sort of looking at the Minnesota GO 50-year vision and narrowing that down. We have our statewide multimodal transportation plan. And then we have a little bit more of a narrow scope, our fiscally constrained plan, which is the 20-year state highway investment plan. We also refer to that as MNSHIP. That really is a 20-year plan. We have years 11 through 20 that are kind of the, you know, the farther out section of that report. And certainly if you're interested in any more detail on that report, we'd be happy to provide that at another time. And then what we refer to as our official work plan is basically the first 10 years. And many of you have heard the first 4 years we referred to as the STIP, the State Transportation Investment Plan. And then the projects actually go to construction. And so you'll see projects in this report that are primarily in that 10-year work plan. We don't really begin developing and planning projects farther out than about 10 years. And then, of course, we lead to construction. The report also highlights environmental mitigation and compliance analysis, essentially two example projects, one project in Greater Minnesota and one project here in the metro area. We typically pick a project that is generally representative of the projects that we have, of the environmental mitigation that we're doing on projects currently. This report lays out two projects, again, the metro project being I-494 in Bloomington. In this case, we had about $350,000 of environmental mitigation out of a $31.7 million overall project. And in Greater Minnesota, we chose the Highway 14 project in Nicolet County. And again, there was a little over $1 million worth of mitigation costs on that project out of the $22.4 million overall project. Just to give you a little bit of context about generally what we look at in terms of mitigation, typical forms of mitigation can include wetland, stormwater ponds, erosion, sediment control, contamination. Some of that can be soil contamination, water contamination. We also deal with noise walls, historic factors, and archaeological impacts as well. The next section in the report you'll find is referred to as the Trunk Highway Fund Expenditures. There are a few caveats I'd like to make about this section, just to be sure that we're all clear on what this is and what it isn't. The statute refers to these 10 categories specifically and requests us to provide information about the amount of spending we've done in those 10 categories. These 10 categories, however, are not mutually exclusive, so this does not represent total trunk highway expenditures. This represents purely the expenditures in those 10 categories. As an example, things such as labor. Labor is category 3 listed here. We also have labor included in the other categories as well. If we have direct labor on a maintenance project, that would show up in line 6, for example. Other things such as litigation expenses or professional and technical contracts may be found throughout as well. Other pieces that are not included in this data that you should be aware of include things like debt service. Debt service is not indicated here, although bond proceeds are included in the spending. Other factors such as general administrative costs, our statewide radio communications expenditures that are related to the Trunk Highway Fund, facilities, information technology investments, and other expenses that are incurred by other state agencies other than MnDOT, principally MMB for debt management and the Department of Public Safety for the State Patrol. Those expenses are also not reflected here.
So, Ms. Hatch, what is reflected in line 10 then?
So line 10 is, and I didn't bring additional detail on that, that is some general administration, particularly project administration, but it is not comprehensive, all of the administrative costs. It does not include things such as workman's comp, unemployment insurance, some of those kind of more general overhead, I guess I should call it, type of costs. Those would be direct administrative expenses listed in line 10. Expenses such as, financial management, human resources, things like that would be reflected there, but would not include all of the general overhead kind of administrative costs. Okay. The statute also required evaluation, actually, of 4 systems that we have currently at the Department of Transportation. This report for 2014 included the results of system evaluations on 2 of our major systems, that being the pavement management system and the bridge management system. In the report previous, you may recall that we had included the systems verification information on the construction management system and the program and project management system. So this effectively concludes the 4 evaluations that we were required to do. As part of this process, however, we have identified that there are some additional systems we would like, as a matter of good practice, to continue to look at. And so with these 2 systems this year, we found, actually our internal audit group found that the evaluations concluded the systems are consistent with existing policy. They are consistent with the need for statewide, reliable, and verifiable information, and they meet the need for properly designed and implemented internal controls. You'll also see in the larger report that I believe you have in front of you, there are some recommendations to management for consideration for what I guess I would refer to as optimization of those systems. But essentially, the systems met the need and the intent that the systems were put into place for, and in fact can be used as a tool to provide information to management and policymakers to make informed decisions about investments.
Ms. Hatch, if you could remind me, what were the two that you had already done in the previous report?
Mr. Chair, those were the construction management system, also referred to as CMS, and the program and project management system, which you've probably heard of referred to as PPMS.
An initiative came out of that last year. And then what you said you identified some for the future. What will those be?
Mr. Chair, I know that our audit director is currently beginning to work on Realms, which is our one of our land management systems, as an example. And I know that there are other systems that this practice has kind of brought to mind that while we do consistent and continuing audits on all of our operations, that this work actually was really useful for us to take a closer look and a look at a different way in terms of the verifiable information coming out of those systems. So I know Realms is one, for example, that I brought up to him to look into, and I'm sure there will be more that we will look into over the course of time as well. So, Mr. Chair, members, moving on, the next section is actually a section I'm very excited about. It's something we've been working on at the department for a few years. I've had the good pleasure to be at the department in the role of CFO for about 4 years, and this has been a vision that I've had for a long time, and so this legislation helped to put it into practice, and it is something that myself and Commissioner Zelli are really, really excited about. The product and services budgeting and spending section of the report, which essentially requires us to budget and report on our budget by products and services. The challenge with this work and why it's taken a lot of work behind the scenes to get to this point is that the current accounting system does not and was not designed to budget by products and services. So it budgets by categories such as payroll and non-payroll, staffing, compensation areas such as benefits, fringe, overtime, general salaries, and then by non-payroll categories such as equipment, contracts, things like that. So this is an entirely different view, a different way to look at where you're spending and how much those products and services are costing. What you see before you here on this slide is essentially our new and improved, if you will, product and services grid. And it very closely, it exactly matches our program and budget activity in the left column. And in the right column, you'll see where it says product and service. These are the products and services that actually touch the customer. And this is why we decided to redesign our products and services. We had our former grid, which was born out of necessity in an era where we did not have the sophistication of the kinds of databases and applications we can take advantage of today. And those systems were not able to collect and roll up data like we're able to now. And so as you see, this is our new products and services grid, and we will be reporting, starting in this report, as I'm sure you're aware, by these categories. In the report, then, we start by looking at the overall summary of the expenditures by these products and services. And so the summary lists all of those products and services and the budget that was expected, the spending that was expected to occur in those areas, followed by the amount spent. I will provide a caveat to the committee that this was 2014 expenditures only. And given that funds are appropriated and we manage our budget on a biennial basis, it makes it a little bit difficult to cut off at a specific point in the year. You have contracts that carry over between years. You have projects that are ready to be let, that might be let but not encumbered until the following fiscal year. There's a little bit of a timing challenge that can occur there. If these numbers were on a biennial basis, I think you would see a slightly different picture. You'd see fewer gaps, whereas now you may see something in the budget column, and you may see expenditures that don't quite match up to it just yet. That is predominantly a timing issue. You'll also notice at the bottom of the report it says direct summary. Those are the direct expenses. And then you'll see agency overhead. So agency overhead there, I have kind of outlined for you on the next slide. These are expenses that are to the department that when we talk about truly what our products and services cost, that we ought to roll into those products and services, never to hide them, never to have them be buried in the product and service, but to truly account for what it costs to deliver those products and services. And so, for example, in agency overhead, we include things such as leave time, fleet support. We have a very large fleet at MnDOT, and it's really hard to tell where that fleet, what product and service that directly supports. If we have a particular vehicle that is on a project, we would count it on that project, but the other fleet vehicles are considered a support activity. We have a lot of buildings, a lot of facilities that we manage and own at MnDOT. We have finance and accounting activities, human resource activities, workforce training, supervision, information technology. We spend in the neighborhood of $38 to $40 million a year, for example, on information technology applications, inventory, equipment, legal services, et cetera. So those are the items that are all included in that agency overhead line. And again, at any time, if there's any information you would like, it broken down, more detail, we'd be happy and able to provide that. Then moving on to the next section of the report, which was a new section last year, and that is the productivity measures section. There are essentially six areas but seven measures. We have two measures in this section related to bridges, inspection cost per square foot of bridge deck area. We have the maintenance cost per square foot of bridge deck area. Then we have our pavement measure, a snow and ice measure, a measure on pavement markings, and a measure on transit, and I will walk through each of those here momentarily. The intent overall of this section of the report, as we understand it, is to demonstrate how well we're delivering our products and services and how well we're leveraging the dollars that have been invested in those products and services to get an outcome. So it's essentially an input-output ratio. So the first measure that I'm going to cover here quickly, and again, we have a lot of other content to get to. If you have questions or want me to elaborate more, I'd be happy to, but I'll go over it a little bit of a high level. There's certainly more detail also in the report, as you know. The inspection cost per square foot of bridge deck area. This is an area that appears to increase over time. One thing that I should note, particularly because our former bridge engineer is sitting next to me, is that the older a bridge gets, the more maintenance activities and the more inspection time and resources are needed to inspect that structure. And so we do see that this is increasing very slightly over time, as you see there. So again, bridges with advanced deterioration require additional time and effort, and complex bridges, which, as you know, we have a lot of complex bridges on our system.
Ms. Hatch, question. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would expect that maybe that aberration there in regards to 08-09 is probably Interstate 35W time frame.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator, actually there was a governor's mandate in 2008 that we go and inspect all of the bridges, and so that's the anomaly in 2008.
Senator Kiffmeyer, if you look at bullet point number two there, governor mandated accelerated inspections for all bridges.
All right, good.
Which is the direct consequence, of course, of the bill that we passed. And actually the funds that the bill provided in our desire to really accelerate and really get a handle on the of all of our bridges.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Chapter 152 was very useful in that as well. Thank you for that. Moving on to the next measure, the maintenance cost per square foot of bridge deck. This is preventative maintenance as well as reactive maintenance. You do see there a slight upward trend as well. And, again, the condition of the bridge system, if the bridge system tends toward maybe a little bit more deterioration or a more complex system that can increase this measure as well. We do everything we can to make sure we keep the numbers as prudent as possible at the end of the day. However, preventative maintenance and reactive maintenance are required on the bridges. And to the extent that we can, we like to do more proactive maintenance. Ms. Dobenberger will discuss that with you momentarily as well, but we do see this trending slightly upward as well. Another measure, a measure in our pavement area that relates slightly to remaining service life, is the cost per additional roadway mile you're added. So the complexity with this measure is, as we do treatments on pavement segments, how much of the life of that asset are we either extending or adding back to the asset? The challenge here is you might be able to do an inexpensive fix, kind of a Band-Aid approach, and you might get an extra couple of years out of that for what might seem like a relatively low-cost investment, as opposed to doing maybe a higher-cost investment and getting a much more significant number of years added to the remaining service life. So there's a little bit of a nuance with this measure, but we think it does provide a reasonable indication that we are trying to decrease the cost of extending the life of our assets over time. And we were interested when the data came out that demonstrated that has been our proactive approach as well. The next measure is the snow and ice cost per plow mile driven. We don't typically measure this, which this measure was really an interesting measure to develop, because we decided that each mile a plow drives is indicative of the severity of the winter. And so while winter severity is something we talk about a lot at MnDOT, and there are probably many engineers that would have lots they'd like to say about that. As you know, winter severity really has an impact on our expenses in terms of snow and ice season. And we might get rain, we might get no snow, and we may have significant expenses from rain, depending on what the forecast is about to do. We may have significant expenses from snow or sleet. We have expenses that vary based on if it's the snow event occurs on on a holiday or on the weekend, as opposed to during the normal portion of the weekday. And so the expenses can be quite variable. At the end of the day, however, we are working very hard to try to drive down the overall cost of each of those winter events. And I guess I would be remiss if I didn't say that there's been a lot of applications that we have applied in the last number of years that I'll discuss here in a little bit as well in terms of efficiencies. But an area that we really struggle with on this side of the business, which is the operating side of the business, is how do we find those efficiencies to help us keep up with the cost of inflation? As inflation sort of eats up our buying power and our base budget isn't changing significantly, how are we able to still deliver the service, still hit those performance targets in snow and ice at that same budget level? And so we have employed things like toe plows, which I'll refer to a little bit more in detail in a minute, anti-icing, salt brine mixtures, de-icing, some additional training for our plow drivers, and things that we do think are helping to drive that number down. We also have a measure here on the cost per mile striped for pavement markings, and this is a downward trend. This is an area that I want to say back in the early 2000s, early to mid-2000s, maybe 2004, we consolidated all of the pavement crews, the pavement marking striping crews that we had that were out located in the districts, and we have found some economies of scale by doing that, and striping crews really have done a good job of trying to leverage those economies of scale and drive those costs down as well. And finally, we have a measure here that's a little bit different from the other measures. This measure really addresses how cost-effectively we are administering grants and services that actually third-party providers actually execute on behalf of the transit ridership in Greater Minnesota. So this measure essentially is about the cost per transit passenger trip. And so the two metrics with that is how can we both drive down our cost and how can we increase ridership by making sure we're working closely with grantees, making sure that we're supporting our grantees, we're making service hours and accessibility more and more on the forefront in greater Minnesota. And so we're working hard on that as well.
So, Ms. Hatch, just to be clear about this number, that's just reflective of, for lack of a better expression, kind of the MnDOT home office expense relating to transit services across the state. That is not the per passenger per ride subsidy.
Correct. That's correct, Mr. Chair. How well are we, how minimally are we, what's the minimal amount of dollars that we are able to use, that we need to use, that we are not passing through to the grantees? So trying to keep those costs low to keep more money flowing out into those local providers to increase the ridership in greater Minnesota.
Great, thanks, because I was going to get really excited about 19 cents for a second. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I mean, this is great, but
I have a question about two parts of your graph that I don't really understand. Because, for instance, back on the bridge inspection cost per square foot of deck area, there's a 3X difference between the cost per square foot for the entire year in 2008. Now, I can see that there'd be a big difference in the expense that you incurred, but we're talking about cost per square foot. Why would it be three times more expensive there? And before we answer, why would it be $5 per mile of plow mile driven cheaper for the whole year? Is there something that I'm missing there? Is there an economy of scale that's showing up in one and not the other? I'm trying to figure out why the per square mile or per mile driven and the per square foot inspected would be so different.
Ms. Hatch.
I'm going to actually see if Ms. Dobenberger can answer that question in more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is Nancy Dobenberger. I'm the MnDOT Assistant Commissioner for Engineering Services Division and formerly the State Bridge Engineer. So I'll take the question about the square foot of bridge deck cost. If I understood the question correctly, it was in 2008, why is it three times the cost per square foot than compared to some of these other years? Bridges are inspected on certain frequencies. They're either inspected on a 24-month cycle or a 12-month cycle if they reach a condition where they're considered structurally deficient. Then they are inspected every 12 months at least. In 2008, many bridges had already been inspected, but then the governor had mandated a program to suddenly inspect all the bridges on the system. So there were almost three times the amount of inspections performed that year. And in fact, all the fracture critical bridges, which fracture critical refers to the way the bridge is designed, but those require an in-depth inspection. Those are every other year that they get the in-depth inspection. Those all had to be inspected with that mandate, and those take more time. So then I should pause. Did that get at the question, Mr. Chair and committee members?
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I don't recall your name now.
Dobenberger.
Okay. Wouldn't that show up in that same about that same amount change in the next round of inspections? That, you know, if you're going to have expensive inspections, you should see a blip somewhere else also, wouldn't you? Maybe, you know, to come up with, to go from 5 cents a square foot to 17 cents a square foot is quite a jump. That's an amazing jump. And I would suspect that some of the 2007 inspections were also in-depth inspections.
Well, Senator Carlson, 2008 was a historic year. That was the year that we passed the last transportation bill. And we passed the infamous Chapter 152, in which we raised a few cents on the gas tax and a good portion of that was devoted specifically to accelerating bridge rehabilitations, bridge improvements. And the governor, who had previous to that point been opposed to the bill, decided it was a good thing that we passed the bill, and it would be a good thing for us to accelerate bridge inspections and get to all of these bridges that were, fracture critical, not necessarily ready to fall down, but if any one portion of them were to break, the whole thing would fall down, and like the 35W bridge was constructed, and also figure out which bridges did have some level of deterioration that needed some quick action. And so 2008 really was a historic moment. We had provided a lot of resources, and there was direction to the agency to use those resources to accelerate the bridge rehab program. And in order for the agency to do that, they needed to really get a handle on what the situation was out there in real life in the field. And I don't have a full explanation for why that caused a spike in the per square foot, but other than it was the more intensive inspection of the types of bridges and more bridges, and just a lot of work had been done that year. So it wouldn't have occurred in the previous year because we didn't have the resources to do it. 2008 was the year that the bill passed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Chair, that is the question, is why per square foot it
right.
went up. And in fact, I would even make the argument that it probably should have gone down, because we would have been doing more inspections. The square footage should have really leapt up, and, of course, the total cost. But when you make a division of those, it should have probably been about the same.
Well, what I heard Ms. Dobbenberger say previously was the types of bridges that take more intensive inspection, that take longer, and more of them were done in a shorter amount of time. And I don't know, was there even more done than would have normally been done, Ms. Dobbenberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could add one more thing to what I was explaining earlier, we did utilize consultants to assist MnDOT with those inspections that year. And due to the acceleration, that additional cost was reflected in those contracts. So yes, we had more time spent per bridge in many of the cases, which contributed to the square foot cost, but then also utilizing consultants along with MnDOT staff added to the price of what we needed
sense.
There. Thank you.
All right. Members, I'll call your attention to the time. We've got less than an hour left and four other subjects to get through. So, right. Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. And Senator Carlson, we'd be happy to get you more detail as follow-up regarding the snow and ice. Thank you. So I will just go really quickly. You'll see the next few slides in your packet refer to the project pages. Again, there are 377 projects listed in the appendix of the report. The threshold for making it into the report is $5 million of a project cost in Greater Minnesota Project. Metro projects that are over $15 million are included in the report. The projects that are programmed for the next 15 years are included in the report, although, as I mentioned earlier, our work plan really only exists in about the 10-year time window. And then we leave projects in the report until they have been substantially complete for 2 years. This table is also in the report. It breaks down, actually, this table. There's an error in this table. The correct number is 377 total projects, and it is correct in the report that you have. The project pages have been expanded this year and include more information about what we're doing, why we're doing it, where we're doing it. More detail can be found in each of those project pages. At the bottom of each page, there's also contact information, so you're welcome to contact that project manager or that individual listed if you'd like more detail on any specific project. And the projects, of course, are also broken down by district, which we understand to be very helpful for a number of the folks who are interested in this report. So we'll move on to look at the overall department efficiencies and what we've been doing with that over the last few years, and in particular the last year or so. There was legislation that was passed last year, and we've been working hard to make sure that we're implementing that and able to report to you on that progress as well. As you know, enhancing financial effectiveness is our strategic priority. I'm sorry, I should tell you where we are. I committed to bringing you along with us, didn't I? So I'm going to ask you in your report, in your packet, to back up to, we're going essentially backwards through the report, back to page 34, the top of page 34 is where I am. And then after this portion, we will go and start at the beginning of your packet. I apologize for that confusion. So our goal is to, our targeted goal really, is to demonstrate our effective and efficient stewardship of public resources, and in fact to increase the effectiveness and efficiency by which we are managing and utilizing those resources. We've been doing a lot of work in three key areas: financial management, asset management, project management. And we're looking essentially, to give you a broad view before I go into the three categories listed, we are looking at what is the best way we can stretch every dollar that we've been provided. What is the maximum use of our capital is essentially where we're going. We're a large agency. We do a lot of different activities. And so in order to provide substantial and documented framework for how we are addressing these things and ways that we can substantiate them, there are essentially three words that I always use, that everything that you should see from MnDOT that has a dollar sign attached to it will be accurate, will be comprehensive, and will be defendable. And so that is the approach that we're taking with all of this efficiency work. We do believe we've been doing things in an efficient manner. That's not to say that there aren't ways we can increase, improve, learn more, and we are doing that in a targeted way. I will also say that as we learn more and do more, we want to make sure we're not throwing out a number flippantly to you or the other stakeholders who are concerned about our efficiency, but that we're able to go back to an accurate, a comprehensive, and a defendable number. So while we are concerned with the overall department spending and use of capital.
Ms. Hatch, question. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hatch, if we haven't already, many of us will be getting some questions in regards to the operations, probably primarily relating around the cost of fuel. You know, my own experience in the operations I'm involved with in 2015, we'll probably be spending $10,000 less in 2015 than we did in 14 per highway heavy vehicle on diesel fuel. Can you give us some insight? Is that going to fall into like your cost avoidance category on your internal cost savings, or where is that going to fall?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, it would fall into the internal cost savings, cost avoidance area. That's correct.
Thank you.
And so as we look at the big category of how do we, how do we efficiently use the capital we've been given, how do we efficiently make sure we're stretching every dollar, there are three categories essentially that we've landed on. We have internal money that stays internal to the department or that the department utilizes directly, and that is either in the state road construction budget area, which is direct projects, operations and maintenance activities, or agency efficiencies. We also have what we call external direct savings, which would be savings that are not monies that MnDOT is responsible for or can control or use on another project, but things that would impact user impacts, benefits, limited detours, things like that. And then there's the external indirect impacts, so ways that we can support the economy, create jobs, and overall make Minnesota stand out economically. As you know, there was statute that was passed last year that required us to demonstrate our savings, our efficiencies, and quantify them, which is the project that we've been working on. In comparison to 5% of our current state road construction budget. That was essentially a placeholder for the commitment that the commissioner has made and the commitment that TFAC sought in the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee report, that the department would help to make up the gap in funding, utilizing more efficient practices to come up to 15% of the gap. And so that is both near-term and long-term as we look at efficient practices we can employ today, as well as how we might be able to maintain the assets in such a way that we would gain greater efficiency over time, which is essentially what I've demonstrated here in this slide. There are activities that we look at in pre-letting, so during project development phases, decisions we can make, really some targeted best practices that we can employ to create savings within the program. In the more real-time current fiscal year, those savings are a little bit more limited when we look at the construction projects. They are already let. They're already out the gate. They are in construction, and we have the contract amount already encumbered in the system, and certainly we can decrease that encumbrance and free up funds if they become available. But often once they're encumbered and a project is underway, they are essentially spoken for and unavailable to be moved on to another project. And then, of course, we have those maintenance and operations efficiencies that I mentioned a little bit earlier that we do find real-time savings, and then we offset those with other needs that we have in the maintenance and operations area. And then, again, as I mentioned a few moments ago, that long-term asset lifecycle approach, making the right investment at the right time to make sure that we're taking care of that asset and reducing the overall expense down the road. So we've been doing a lot of analysis looking predominantly at the pre-letting, but also at the operations and maintenance efficiencies. And we've been doing this analysis. We just started with looking at projects that were let in 2015 and that are $10 million and over. And the goal is not just to look back and kind of backcast, but to both look back at what we have been doing, what can we do better in any of those projects, what were opportunities that might have been missed, but also looking to create lessons and a framework that we can then use moving forward in fiscal year 16 and beyond to implement best practices that might have been a good idea that happened on one project, and we'd like to see them happen on more or all projects. This slide then shows where we are relative to the target. This is effective as of the 27th, so today. The goal, that 5% goal, is just over $60 million for fiscal year 15, and we have identified $36.8 million in efficient decisions or efficient choices we've made or changes we've made to projects that have resulted in us being able to do effectively more in 2015 than when we would otherwise have been able to afford to do had we not employed those practices and made those decisions. We've also identified $4.3 million in efficiencies that we've saved this year in maintenance and operations. And again, we're redeploying those resources to other maintenance and operations activities. Just to give you a high-level view of these six categories are really where we're finding most of those efficiencies in the state road construction area. Again, in the pre-letting activities, value engineering, alternative technical concepts, although that does take place after letting, in consultation with the contractor, design optimization, contract design flexibility, innovative delivery methods, and then traffic control. And again, if you have any questions on that, we'd be just happy to answer them. This is a list of the projects that we have identified those cost savings on, those efficiencies in the state road construction budget on. And again, those dollars were then repurposed to other areas needing funding in the current fiscal year. The maintenance and operations area, the number I read earlier, the 4.3, is derived from the employment of tow plows. Tow plows on the system do save significant resources, and we've conservatively estimated that at $490,000 per year. The use of the maintenance decision support system, which allows our plow drivers to have real-time information about road, weather conditions. We'd see a lot of savings, particularly in salt and brine applications, as we are able to give our plow drivers a little bit more detailed and targeted information about what that road system requires at that moment, as opposed to what a generic amount to put down of application that might take place in other parts of the state. And then we have these automated flagger devices, which $13,000 doesn't seem like a lot, but we're really excited about that amount as an annual savings to the department. And these devices have a useful life of about 10 years. And so per device, that's $133,000, and we're pretty excited to see that application. So where do the savings go? Essentially, this is where the savings have gone. The savings that we had on all of those projects that I mentioned, that $36 million was used to balance the 2015 program. As you might expect, some projects come in under budget and some projects come in over budget. In addition to over budget projects that come in, you know, just higher than we expected, there's also a number of cases where there are supplemental agreements needed on a contract. There might be soil or contamination remediation issues that a contractor finds once they get into a project. There might be additions to the project that occur due to local community involvement throughout the project. And so some of these project costs do get higher than the initial letting cost. And so we do use these savings to balance and be able to keep those other projects on schedule. We're able to advance, in some cases, projects from the following year. We were able to pull some projects forward and complete those in 2015. And then that, of course, leaves a gap in the following year, which we're able to bring a new project into. We have two other pieces that I don't think we talk about very much, but they're really useful financial management tools that we use, where we convert advanced construction. Advanced construction is the tool that we use with managing our federal funds. We are a state, quite frankly, I'll brag a little bit, we employ this really well, and we're probably one of the best states that use this. And as a result, every year when other states are unable to use all of their federal funds, we receive in August what's called August redistribution. And that can be anywhere from $8 million to $20 million. And essentially what it is FHWA will look at states, at how they're spending and how they're able to utilize their federal funds for that year. And if there's a state that's not able to use their federal funds, and there are many states that give up federal funds every year, then FHWA looks to Minnesota and a few other states and says, can you use the money? And we have never turned away federal money. So we will take that money, we will use this advanced construction, and we will use that as well. And also early let late awards, we use that mechanism to make sure that we're maximizing the funding that we have every year. I mentioned earlier that the lessons that we've learned by looking back at these projects in fiscal year 15 will be used as we implement best practices
into the future. So we have Senator Kiffmeyer, Senator Peterson, Senator Jensen. Senator Jensen, Senator Kiffmeyer, Senator Peterson. Mm-hmm. Senator Jensen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Slide 38, and you've said it a couple times about the lessons learned. Do you have that information someplace? What are the lessons that we've learned? Are they in the report?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we actually have a lot of lessons that we've learned, and we have a lot of documentation. I don't think that level of detail made it in the report, but we could definitely forward that to the committee.
That would be great. That would be really interesting. Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's commendable and good to hear that, especially I know for those projects that were moved up. But one of the advantages here that I see, though, is that these should be repeatable every year. I mean, this is not just a one-time savings. This is a year-on-year savings plus lessons learned. Is that the case that you would say?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. The only difference would be that not every project is the same, and so some of these applications are a little bit more applicable to some projects than others. Again, you might have a really innovative practice that you apply on a certain type of pavement project that might be applicable to other similar pavement projects, but might be entirely different for a bituminous project versus a concrete project or a bridge project versus. So that is exactly what we're intending to do, is take these lessons learned, see where they would be most applicable, and then do apply them to those, or at least make sure that they're being reviewed with that lens if that seems to be an appropriate application of that. And as we do this and the farther we get, and we have, as I mentioned, that's one of our strategic priorities as well. So as we get farther along and have more of these lessons learned, it is becoming and will become even more so just normal practice, just more embedded in the way that we think about these types of projects.
It seems like they started with efficiencies on your titles. Let's see, Deputy Commissioner, Chief Operating Officer, and Chief Financial Officer. Was that one of the efficiencies?
You're paid double or triple.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I wish I could say it was not more efficient for the department, but as it turns out, it probably is. Yeah, one salary and, a lot to juggle. But I think the commissioner had all of these kind of things in mind as we're moving forward. His vision when he came into the department was very much that the department would move this direction. And he and I had a shared vision about that. And so,
always good to start at the top.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hatch, and I'm not sure if you're able to answer the question, but I'm happy to try and direct it to whoever you'd ask me to contact. You know, Senator Dibble took us out to the Minnesota Research Road Project in Monticello in the past, and, you know, from my perspective, who have folks that drive by that many times a week, quite frankly, in that commute and every day, yep. Can you offer some insight? Has that research facility been able to offer you some efficiencies that you're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we haven't looked specifically at that facility in terms of these efficiencies, but I'm fortunate to have Mr. Engstrom sitting next to me, who is, as I mentioned, the director of the Office of Materials and Road Research, and the Min Road facility falls under his area, if I may.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Engstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thanks for asking that question. I get to brag a little bit. Minro's been in operation for 20 years.
You can just introduce yourself formally.
I'm sorry, I'm Glenn Engstrom. I'm the director of the Office of Materials and Road Research for MnDOT. MnRoad has been in operation for 20 years, and we're currently in our second phase. Our first phase, we completed a return on investment document to determine exactly what you're asking. And we determined that for every dollar put in, we got back $8.9. We've done a lot of things related to pavement thickness, pavement structural design, related to when we put on spring load restrictions and winter overloads. We've done a variety of things out there, and it's been a huge success.
Thank you. Yeah. So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Engstrom, so from your perspective, you'd be confident that the staff at MnDOT is open to the research and is implementing those items that you've identified, and maybe you could walk us through how you get that research actually into the engineering department and into the projects.
Mr. Engstrom, I know you have a presentation. Should we just dive into that, or Mrs. Hatch, how do you want to handle?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we could either discuss that today and move forward into Mr. Engstrom's presentation. If you'd prefer a discussion on that's a little bit more targeted, we'd be happy to either come back and provide more comprehensive information on that topic or provide it as part of follow-up and see what you'd like to do.
Why don't you take a quick stab at the response if it's not embedded in your presentation, and then we'll just proceed with the rest of the presentation as you see fit.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to wait if that's preferable.
However you would like to handle the response.
Mr. Chair, I could take a quick stab at it.
Great.
A lot of the experiment out there is structural, basically how thick the materials need to be to withstand the loads and the environmental loads. One of the big things we've done recently is we have new software to design concrete pavements, reconstructed concrete, and this new software results in anywhere between an inch to an inch and a half of savings on concrete. So if it was originally 9 inches, it would be 8 inches thick or 7.5. And that's used directly by our materials engineers across the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I had a follow-up question for Ms. Hatch. Also working off page 38 there, and you talked about your top slide annualizing the savings from maintenance and operations. So what I would like to be able to say to the residents I serve is that, so for example, going back to the fuel example, there will clearly be millions of dollars in savings on diesel fuel, not only this year, but probably, a number of years into the future. So with the reprogramming slide that you have below, is it accurate for us to say that, for example, the savings in maintenance and operations will absolutely result in more miles of road being done?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would say that it would be incorrect.
Okay.
I would say that savings that we find in the state road construction budget on projects, those absolutely you would see those impacting one of the top four, either balancing the current program because of overruns on other projects, advancing other projects, et cetera. In the operations and maintenance area, what you will find, though, if when we find savings in any area, those dollars are directly applied back into the maintenance and operations area. So activities you might see as a result of savings on fuel would be additional patching, additional paving, guardrail repair, striping, signage repair, maybe getting buying additional salt ahead of time on this year's contract so that we have savings for the following year. We do that every year, but we particularly try to do that the first year of the 2 years of the biennium so that we can save for the next year. Salt goes up every year, as an example. So you would definitely see impacts to that, but it would be on the operations and maintenance side.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Carry on.
Mr. Chair, I think the next piece we'd like to do is to have Ms. Dobenberger walk us through how highway projects are selected. We also have in your packet, as well as we're prepared to go over information related to our bridge management and our pavement management. If you feel like we're not going to get to that today and you'd like us to come back, we're happy to do that. But we understood that project selection might be of a higher priority for the committee today.
The person to whom it's the most important is not here.
What? What?
Well, it's important to all of us, but the guy who keeps bringing it up is not here. So why don't we go to the other items, and if he arrives, then see if we can get to it. Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, then we will move on to managing Minnesota's bridges, and I will tell you what page you can find that on in your. So going from the front of your packet, you would want to turn to page 8. The top of page 8 is where Ms. Dobenberger will start. Great, regarding Minnesota's bridges.
Dobenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, this is Nancy Dobenberger, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Engineering Services of MnDOT. And thank you for letting me come today to talk about bridges. As I mentioned, I was previously the state bridge engineer, so bridges are still very near and dear to me. And so I'm going to just touch on, at a higher level, three general categories of how we look at managing Minnesota bridges. It's kind of a three-legged stool. We have on the left side there of this figure the assessment, and that includes our bridge inventory, so our database, inventorying bridges, getting the information in the database. And that information also comes from safety inspections, which I had talked about previously. Those are done on routine cycles. And then preservation, a very important part of our asset management when it comes to bridges as well as pavements. And when we talk about preservation work, we talk about preventive maintenance as well as reactive maintenance. And then also the far right, we have the improvement category. That is where we consider major bridge rehabilitation to fall within, as well as bridge replacement, and even bridge widenings would fall within the improvement part of this structure here. And so bridges by the number. These numbers are sent in to our Federal Highway Administration annually by April 1st, and so actually by next month, all the bridge owners are going to have their information, Minnesota bridge owners, into our database, and these numbers will be updated once again for a submittal to the FHWA on April 1st. But when we talk about Minnesota bridges, by statute, any bridge that has a span of 10 feet or greater is any structure with a span of 10 feet or greater is considered a bridge. So bridges between 10 and 20 feet, a lot of those are box culverts. But the breakdown is shown here as such. State highway bridges, so state highways and interstates, comprise about 23% of the system of bridges in Minnesota. And then county, township, and city bridges comprise about 73%. So the additional 4% are other owners, like a railroad, state parks, local parks, that sort of thing, and federally owned bridges, federal lands. And I wanted to bring up this figure today to show and to kind of set the stage for talking about bridge management and investments. This is a rather crude or rough bridge deterioration model. So on the left side or the y-axis, you see NBIS condition code from 9 to 3. It's about where we have any bridges of that condition that are still open. But 9 is usually a brand new bridge. And then once it reaches 4, that's poor condition. 3 is also in poor condition. But this shows that if you assume about an 85 or so year life of a bridge, right around age 40, it's going to have declined to the point where a major investment is needed to get the additional 40, 45 years of life out of the bridge. So in the work in between, there you can't ignore a bridge, of course. It needs to go through its inspections, but it also needs preventive maintenance, just routine maintenance, crews taking care of the bridges, and also reacting to things they might find during an inspection. So there's investments along the way, but then a major investment is typically required around the halfway point of its life. Oftentimes that's a complete deck replacement for our bridges. That's usually what the major investment is there, along with other rehabilitation. And this is an important graph I wanted to show today. This lumps the bridges into decades that they were built. And so you can see that once you get into the early to mid, primarily mid-60s, 1960s to mid-70s, suddenly there's a spike in the number of bridges that were built, and that's reflective of the interstate era. So then other programs have come along since then. We built more bridges on our system. And as I mentioned in the previous slide, somewhere around 40 years of life, 40 to 50, a large investment's due. We've been able to make a lot of progress on our condition of bridges through the Chapter 152 program, but many of these bridges in this bridge bubble or baby boom of bridges are going to need to be addressed just past the Chapter 152 program. So past 2018, we're going to see a lot more bridge needs come upon us. So how are we doing? This graphic shows some of our performance measures. We have targets shown here for bridges in good condition, so the target is 55% or greater, and then bridges in poor condition, which our target for percent poor is 2% or less. If we were to have a target of anything less than 2%, we'd likely be replacing bridges before their time. That's about the number of bridges in the inventory that we can address at any given time. So as you can see, the numbers are, as far as percent poor, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, those are typically our structurally deficient bridges. They're going down, and they're projected to continue to go down near that 2% by the end of the Chapter 152 program in 2018. Also, the percent good. In fact, we're replacing a lot of our major river crossings with the Chapter 152 bridge program. And with that, we're replacing a lot of large bridges. These measures, and I apologize for not mentioning in the beginning, are by square foot of bridge. And so larger bridges have a significant impact on this. So we anticipate looking good and progressing well toward the end of the Chapter 152 bridge program. But I'd like to show these numbers as well. Now, this is by number of bridges. This is the Better Bridges magazine comes out annually in November with their bridge inventory, and they compare states. And for structurally deficient bridges, so again, by number of bridges, so a little different than the previous slide, for interstate and state highway bridges, so the MnDOT-owned bridges, our total structurally deficient is 2%. Then the way that compares is there are 5 states who are doing better. They're around 1%. 4 states who are tied, and 41 states worse. And so, like I mentioned just a bit ago, we're making tremendous progress with the Chapter 152 bridge program. And then the second bullet there talks about when you include the city, county, and township bridges, we are more in the middle of the pack there. We are still doing relatively well. 8% is where we're at there. So 21 states better, 6 states tied, and 23 states worse. Just to touch on a little bit of program changes since the bridge collapse, we have different processes in place now with quality assurance and quality control. And one thing I like to mention in particular is with complex bridges now, we require a completely independent design check. So not only have an engineer check the design of the engineer of record, but have a separate engineer do a separate design that will ultimately check the engineer of record's design. So that's an independent quality control item that we implement. And then we've put a limitation on construction loads that can be on bridges. We've increased inspections on fracture-critical bridges, looked at different ways to rate truss bridges based on the knowledge that came out of the investigation of the 35W bridge, and a different way of reporting critical findings and reacting to critical findings from inspections. I mentioned the Chapter 152 bridge program. We've made tremendous progress there. And then the next two items I list are databases or applications that help us manage our system. One is the database for bridge information, and then one is a bridge risk management system that we use for decision making on projects. Just to touch on where we're at with the Chapter 152 program, briefly about that legislation passed in 2008 by the legislature, accelerated the repair and replacement of trunk highway bridges, so state bridges, and now it's a part of Chapter 155 statute, but we still refer to it as Chapter 152 program at MnDOT.
Great. Ms. Gobenberger, we have a question. Senator Carlson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the things that I've noticed in the past year is that bridge inspections are no longer accessible by the public. Was that something that changed recently, or is that has that been a change in policy, and how does one get the access to looking at some of the bridges that they may be concerned about?
Ms. Dobenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. After the 35W bridge collapsed, we went to the effort of putting all the bridge inspections on the website. So from the accelerated inspection program that the governor mandated, we put all those on our website. Since then, we haven't kept up with putting all the inspections on our website. It's something we could certainly do. When we get requests for inspection information, we provide those reports at request.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And who does that request go to? I have a constituent that has been asking for access to some certain bridges, and I think by intersection or by road, I don't remember which, not the number of the bridge, but I went on to the website and couldn't find any link to them.
Ms. Dobenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What typically happens at MnDOT with requests for information like that, they come into our information desk, and if it's anything related to a bridge, it goes to the state bridge engineer. So in that case, it would have been me or someone in the bridge office responding. But on that note, too, we can have further discussions about making it more accessible so that there's no need to go through the info desk, too. So that's something I can take back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Continue.
This is something I like to touch on is the accomplishments through the Chapter 152 program. So it's a 10-year program, 2008 to 2018. There were 172 bridges that fell within the program that were either structurally deficient at the time or fracture critical. And of those 172 bridges, there were 35 that were judged to only need routine maintenance or privately owned or don't carry trunk highway traffic. So those weren't identified for funding through the program. However, of the ones that were, 94 are substantially complete. 8 others will be completed by the end of this upcoming construction season. And another 35 are scheduled for, to be under construction between 2016 and 2018. Okay, now I'd like to just touch on a little bit about our structure information management system. This is a system that we put in place soon after the I-35W bridge collapse. This was an integrated system between bridge inventory information that came about from inspections to link that with maintenance work that was performed on bridges. So it was an integrated system. That's just a look at what one of the information screens looks like. And so when I talk about bridge inspections, I mentioned fracture-critical bridge inspections, which are in-depth inspections. There are also routine bridge inspections where basically the bridge inspectors are out there looking at routine elements on a routine basis. Excuse me. Underwater bridge inspections, those are for bridges that have foundations that are underwater that aren't accessible other than with divers who are also certified bridge inspectors. And then special inspections, and those are for bridges that have some special components. Okay. And this is just a little bit more about what our database does. It contains bridge information, but also finds a bridge on a map. We can get a street view. We can plot where the bridges are. We can quantify data. So this system has been working very well for us, and these are some capabilities it has. The National Bridge Inspection Standards, wanted to touch on those. Nationally, there are requirements for bridge owners. And in Minnesota, like other states, the state DOT is the program manager. So although in Minnesota, the local agencies are in charge of doing their own bridge inspections, MnDOT is responsible for reporting those federally and ensuring they comply with these federal standards for bridge inspections. This slide just shows some photos of deterioration that can be noted, and these are very extreme cases, but they show what we might be looking for. So steel corrosion on a steel beam, a rocker bearing over on the right that's tilted more than what we'd normally expect, and then the lower left shows some concrete deterioration. Wanted to mention load ratings. Part of what we do in managing our bridges is determine the safe load-carrying capacity of our bridges, something we do while we design a bridge, but we might have a need to revisit that if there are new trucks on the system that have different axle spacings or might pose heavier weights onto our bridges. If something is noted during inspection that might give us concern that the bridge might have less capacity, we need to re-rate a bridge for its load-carrying capacity.
So Ms. Dubenberger is... It looks like a rope bridge in the Amazon. The
second yeah, one. That was just a cute one that I found somewhere. That, okay. Concern.
Is that actually
sorry.
Minnesota?
Is it in Minnesota?
Oh, okay. That one
right.
is not.
Great. I'm happy about that. All right. Thank you. And also, the person in question is
it's
in the room who would likes to hear about our selection process. So if we can get to that really soon, that would be Senator Senjum. I'm outing him. So Senator Senjum, we have a special section for you, and we waited for you to arrive for that. So we'll get to that. A special section that we're going to hear about.
Oh, grid. Good, good.
Yeah, about project selection process.
Mr. Chair, as long as you paid attention to me, may I ask a question?
Yes.
For instance, on the bottom of our page 17, where we've got the bad situations at... the angled support or whatever in a situation or in those situations, and of course, you know, you can't tell from pictures how bad that really is, but is that like a great big timeout? Oh my gosh, we've got to take some immediate action, or is it just a ho-hum, we'll watch it for a while?
Ms. Dubenberger, I see you have something about emergency response towards the end. Circumstance like this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the question is in regards to what happens when we see deterioration or condition that seems extreme. That's what we consider a critical finding. So that's noted during the inspection. Typically, then what happens is the inspector, they might be able to make a call themselves that that's okay. We might need to do something differently with monitoring that sort of situation. But oftentimes it's a call back to the MnDOT bridge office, photos, or somebody's making a site visit to assess that a little more closely. Then we'll do oftentimes a structural analysis to see if it is something where we need to possibly restrict traffic on the bridge or close it altogether until we know more or are able to address it. But that is a correct statement that these extreme cases, they're noted as critical findings, and that is a big timeout if that is found in the field.
Just to follow up, and I think you probably answered the question, but in the vernacular, you have a cash drawer to go to, you know, if one of these costs $100,000 or $500,000 to repair, is that, you have that money available? It would be non-budgeted is my point, but you have some set aside for these kind of situations?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm going to just answer that since I'm the CFO. We would turn over heaven and earth to find the dollars internally if we could, especially if it was a critical need that needed to be addressed or resulted in a closure. If we needed to, we would look at the overall program. We would modify the program. We would advance projects. We would use some of these other mechanisms I referred to earlier. I do also, it's a large department. It has a huge operating budget and a huge construction budget. I do maintain a small risk reserve within the department budget to handle situations that we would need immediate access to cash for. And if the situation would, be towards the end of the biennium, that would, where the funds really, truly were not available, we would make a quick call and see if we could get your support and your assistance to fund a project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Kiffmeyer.
I know that we're running short on time. I don't know if, I think we're all really interested. This is just a really great opportunity. My question had to do with the load ratings on the slide on page 18 to understand a little bit more how you do that. And I suspect on bridges that there's not only just the rating as far as the actual weight, but that this may have something to do with axles or distribution as well. I just want to give you an opportunity to respond to that, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Dobenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, even though we got Senator Senjum into the room to hear about the project selection process, and we haven't even gotten to the materials management presentation, we only have 10 minutes left. I don't think we'll be able to do the subject justice. So why don't we just finish up the bridge report, and then we'll come to those other two items at the future meeting. Does that sound? Thanks. So if you could respond to Senator Kiffmeyer's question, and then why don't you finish out your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The question about load rating, that is absolutely right, that we take into account the vehicle configuration, so the number of axles and how they're spaced, and then also, of course, the weight and how that's distributed on those axles. And then the length of bridge spans also contributes to the load carrying capacity. So for long vehicles, certainly there might be axles that wouldn't all be contained on one particular span. They might go on to another span. So that has to do with how a bridge is load rating, too. So those are some of the key factors.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Continue.
Okay. I may continue just a little more on bridge operations and maintenance. So for maintenance, what our crews do, MnDOT has bridge crews throughout the state in each of the districts, and they integrate condition assessment with the work that's needed. So they identify the needs during inspections, repairs are prioritized and scheduled, and then the effectiveness of the maintenance program is assessed too. And we do that with our SIMS program that I mentioned earlier. And this just touches on a screen that does some resource scheduling management. Bridge information versus maintenance costs are evaluated, and then we can look at investment levels as well. This slide just shows some examples of preventive bridge maintenance. So this is a routine type of maintenance that needs to be done to bridges to extend their service life. Here you can see examples of deck flushing, deck joint flushing. There's some crack sealing going on here, and then just general component cleaning and that sort of thing needs to be done to keep our bridges in a state of good repair. And then, as I mentioned earlier, if something is noted during an inspection that needs to be reacted to quickly, we call that reactive bridge maintenance. Here's some examples of things that have been found that need to be addressed quickly, and MnDOT bridge crews, for the most part throughout the state, can address a lot of the problems they see in the field that are kind of routine maintenance or reactive maintenance as well. I'll just touch on also how we respond to emergencies. And here are some big, interesting examples of things that happen. I think that the most common emergency we need to react to with bridges are vehicular hits to our bridges. And these are some photos of what we've seen out there. But then also floods. Floods, of course, can do a lot of damage to bridges over water with the phenomenon called scour that rivers can cause by high water flows, which undermine the foundations. Just wanted to also mention, as of just a few years ago, we put into effect, we've instituted a bridge maintenance academy. So it helps us transfer knowledge from experienced bridge maintenance workers to newer bridge maintenance workers, as well as we've opened these courses up to the local agencies as well. And then to touch on how we decide on projects, bridge planning and programming. I mentioned our bridge system. That takes the inventory and inspection information and puts it in. It draws from the SIMS program, puts it into an analysis that takes into account condition and other things, and comes out with a bridge programming index. So it's really kind of a risk index, but it also generates a suggested work type, a cost estimate, and a time frame that that work should be done. So that's the output. And that enhances our bridge improvement planning. And this, I just wanted to mention, this next slide shows a graphic of how it is classic risk-based planning. It takes into account the probability of a service interruption, so the age of the bridge, the condition of the bridge, elements of the bridge that need to be taken into consideration as to what could go wrong with it, and then the consequence. And consequence talks about the service interruption itself. So if we had to close it down to do an emergency type of repair, how long is the detour? What's the traffic volume that would need to be detoured? And generally, what's the impact to the public? Those basic components get taken into account as we do our risk-based planning for bridges. And yeah, when we talk about the consequence, we talk about service interruption. That's normally what needs to take place to react to something. So it is all very data-driven when it comes to bridge asset management, much like the pavement management as well. So I will pause there for any bridge questions. Great.
Thanks, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Ms. Dobenberger. Good to see you. I think the last time I saw you was in Hastings. So I was really intrigued with your comment about, you know, the most common reason for the reactive maintenance being the vehicular hits. And it made me think that there might be, you know, an interesting education in there just to understand what are the types of reasons that cause these needs. I don't know if you have a breakdown for that off the top of your head or if you could get that back to us. But I think it'd be interesting for people to understand, you know, this is what happens. It's not just time and weather.
Ms. Dobenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Oftentimes what happens, and I don't have a good breakdown, something I could look into is certainly get that information to the committee, but one of the most frequent things we see out there when it comes to a vehicular hit is a vehicle towing something that has maybe a hydraulic arm that wasn't quite tied down, or it hit a bump and something came loose and something popped up and hit the bridge. And so oftentimes it's the exterior girder or a couple of girders. Oftentimes then the reaction to that is possibly just closing the outside lane that was affected of the bridge above until we can assess that better and come back and fix it. But there are all sorts of different things that could cause a vehicular hit, but that's probably one of the more frequent things.
And just as a quick follow-up, I'm more interested in, you know, there's this perception that, you know, the only reason we have to deal with bridges is because time, weather, whatever, wears it down. But, you know, the notion that we actually inflict a lot of damage ourselves on our infrastructure, I think might surprise people to the degree to which that happens. So I'd be curious to see. Thank you.
Ms. Dobenberger.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the question in there.
It's more about the categories of what causes the reactive maintenance, what provokes the reactive maintenance.
Ms. Dumber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I can get a breakdown of that and provide that to the committee.
Great.
As well.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, members? Just a quick question about railroad bridges. You identified them on the grid, and how do we? I know they're privately owned by the railroads themselves. We do have an inspections function, a railroad inspector. How do we handle and manage that function?
Mr. Chair, Railroad bridges are they do inspections, certainly. MnDOT inspects them as they span over our roadways. So those that are over public roadways, in particular state highways, MnDOT inspects some, or a local agency bridge inspector if it was over a local road. However, there are parts of the bridge that we don't have access to, the railroad does, and they do their inspections. But we look at as much as we can that we have access to as they span over our highways.
What about the railroad inspectors that have FRA delegated authority, not necessarily out of your shop, but the railroad inspectors? I think we had this question from Senator Dietzick when we had the railroad report in, but I don't remember the answer. The rail inspectors that work for MnDOT, do they inspect the bridges?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, they are not bridge inspectors. So the bridge inspectors for MnDOT are just those who are trained in highway bridge inspection, but they are the staff who look at the bridges as much as possible. So the as much as we can possibly access. So as far as the rail inspectors for MnDOT, I'm not certain of all of their duties, but they're not the bridge inspectors.
Okay. All right. We need to talk some more about that. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, just to mention Senator Jensen, the
one question I have for you on the bridges is
the black iron. And I noticed on your chart here, and I was trying to look and see on bridge condition, in my district, I have several black iron. Does that factor in to this chart as well? Is that one of the factors?
Ms. Dobenberger.
I believe the question is in regards to iron bridges or
black iron.
Black supports. Oh. The supports to the bridge. I'm sorry, not a bridge. You know what, Mr. Chairman? I'm thinking of an overpass. Would not be a bridge over water. It would be an overpass on a highway.
I think
it's a bridge deck.
Ms. Dobenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I believe the question is in reference to iron bridges or truss bridges. Is that the type of bridge? Are you thinking of steel steel girders?
We can deal with this another time, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to clarify and work on that, okay?
Okay. Additional questions, members? All right. Okay. Sorry. Now, where are we in the agenda?
Madam Chair, we are completed with the bridge management portion. The other portions that we were prepared to talk about today, but we'd be delighted to also have the opportunity to come back and provide another conversation at another day that could warrant the time, would be how do we select projects, kind of the project selection process. We'd be happy to go into a great amount of detail on that. And then we also are prepared to discuss our pavement management, much like we did with bridge management. We have a whole pavement management protocol.
Both very interesting topics to this group of people, and I know we will want to spend time talking about it. So if you would be so kind as to come back another time so that we will have time to do that, that would be most appreciated. Senator Peterson.
Thank you. Excuse me, Madam Chair. It sounds like we're concluding here, and one question that had kind of come up was relating to the governor's transportation budget, and I should have tried to catch Senator Dibble before he left, but are you aware, are we going to have the governor's staff come in and present that his transportation plan?
Yes, I believe we're going to have three, well, including public safety, then we'll have a MnDOT presentation, and then we'll also talk to Met Council and CTIP.
So
three
Madam Chair, are those going to start next week, do you think? Or
yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Sinjum. I know we're. Can I just maybe set? This is probably my. You know, how do you select projects? It's a question I've had, and I had it last year, and we talked about it a little bit. But maybe just to set the stage, some of us, and maybe all of us, from time to time, I like Senator Jensen, for instance. Okay, we campaign, we come up here, we're elected, we talk about Highway 14, and others amongst you talk about your projects, and. And they're all good projects, and if you put them on a chart, you know, the criteria in terms of value and so on, it's all right there, and they're all good and so on. But it just seems to me that at some point in time, someone, some group, or some person has to, you know, kind of huddle up, go in a room, and decide we're going to do this one, this one, this one, this one, this one, and then our $1.3 billion is spent, and we can't do anymore. That's kind of like, you know, if that's true, just explain that process a little bit, because, you know, we go back to our district engineers, and it's hard to get an answer out of them. So I think most of this does come out of St. Paul, and if you could just maybe help clarify that for us, because time in and time out, we have to explain to people, even though we don't know the answer, we have to explain to people, to the best of our ability, how these things get either decided or not decided.
Ms. Hatch.
Madam Chair, Senator, we have a great deal of information on that we can provide, and we'd be happy to do it. The short version of the answer to that question is we have data, we have metrics, we have performance of both the system and the individual asset that we look at. We get input from our districts, from our engineers that are the experts on the pavement and the asset itself in terms of which are a higher priority to replace, for example, at what time. We also do reach out in our local area transportation partnerships to get local input into what projects they would recommend. And we have two different funding pools, if you will. We have the statewide performance program, and we have the district risk management program that we use to make sure that there's resources that we can make sure that both the local needs are addressed to the extent that we possibly can, as well as making sure that statewide the driver experience is not compromised in one area of the state over another, to make sure that pavement performance, for example, stays in a similar condition statewide. So in short, we have a number of metrics that we use when we look at performance. We have a number of experts that we reach out to, and we do, of course, take very seriously the needs of the local communities. And it's a pretty complicated process, but we definitely don't want it to either seem or be perceived as happening kind of in a back room. We want that very much to be out in the light. And I think for a long time, you know, we just made some assumptions about people's the general awareness of how that process is, and so we are happy to bring that into the light and certainly seek input into improvements to that process. We'd be happy to share greater detail.
Thank you, Ms. Hatch, and Senator Senjum. We all share a lot of interest in that, and that's why I think it's important that we not try to rush through it today and spend some real time listening to the specifics. So, okay, with that, do we have any other questions as we proceed? With that, our meeting is adjourned.